Welcome back to Building Tomorrow, a podcast about tech, innovation, and the future. Today, we're discussing what social media companies should do when the idea of internet virality suddenly becomes literal. That viral post that your boomer uncle shared on Facebook back in March or April about how Anthony Fauci conspired with Bill Gates to invent COVID-19 so they could get rich off a vaccine. It's probably the same uncle who gets drunk at family reunions and starts yelling a lot about conspiracy theories. What should Facebook do about that post? I mean, on the one hand, they might have an obligation to remove disinformation about the virus, because in this case, disinformation can kill people. At the same time, removing posts simply because they are false and not because they're obscene or call for violence or whatever, well, that can get messy really quickly. Sometimes truth can be in the eye of the beholder. It strikes people as a kind of censorship. So how should Facebook and really any social media company decide what content to remove? My guest today is my colleague at Cato, John Samples. And John was recently appointed to Facebook's Independent Oversight Board. It's the board that will take on the toughest content moderation cases. And that means that John is going to be one of the voices in the room that will shape the future of Facebook's approach to free speech issues. And given that there are 2.6 billion Facebook users worldwide, that's an important role. And it's one I'm glad to see a committed civil libertarian take on. The announcement that you were going to be part of Facebook's Independent Oversight Board, mm-hmm. It was in May. I mean, you obviously knew about it before the rest of the world, but that's right in the middle of the pandemic. How has the pandemic thrown the kind of plan for the rollout of the Independent Oversight Board? Has it thrown a wrench in the works at all?
Now, there's an interesting question here that I believe the idea was before the pandemic hit, was that there was always going to be a lot of the work, maybe most of the work done by the oversight board was going to be done online. When we do have meetings, you become completely aware of the problems here because just the time issue, right? It's often 6 a.m. or whatever here in the West Coast, and then it's 11 p.m. at night, and there's almost a whole day's difference in all of that. So there was always going to be these online challenges, but it was going to have to be that because people are spread throughout the world. I think there was going to be face-to-face meetings a couple of times a year. So in some sense, things did not change. And I believe almost certainly the role, getting people up to speed, learning your role and on processes. I bet all of that was going to be online, even if we hadn't had, not all of it, but much of it. There would have been some meeting face-to-face, but I suspect a lot of it would still have been the way we're doing it. Indeed, when you look at what they're doing, I don't think they could put that together in a month or two. It's a fairly complicated kind of schooling, really, to learn the processes and what we're doing. It's pretty impressive if they did it in a very short time, but I suspect there was always going to be an online. So I suspect in the end that in terms of how fast we get to work, the pandemic probably didn't matter. Or probably won't matter much. In itself, I don't think it is delayed, would be my guess.
Hmm. Well, it's fitting, the kind of online services from internet provision itself to the content providers hasn't really been disrupted by the pandemic. It's the stuff that we haven't digitized. It's the bits of the world that haven't been eaten by software, to use Andreessen's phrase, that mm-hmm. those are the parts that have struggled the most in response to the pandemic. So,
there's another aspect to this because in our work so far, I think this is no great surprise, but it reemphasized it for me, which is, a crucial part of the success of this enterprise is going to be based unfortunately. I mean, I'm an intellectual, I'm an ideas guy, but a lot of it has to do with people and their relationship with one another. And in some measure, the success of this will be based around the idea, how well can this group of people work together, particularly deliberate together? How well can they support free expression, that is a big Facebook value, when they disagree about other things, right? And I think they can do that better if they know each other better. And it's just like the seminars at Stanford. There's a face-to-face element that is irreplaceable. Now, we've done actually pretty well with some small group discussions online. I thought that was actually a pretty good substitute. So I'm pretty confident that we're doing surprisingly well, but I'm wondering, you know, how much, you know, I'm hopeful we'll get to see each other soon, because I think that also has an additional element and will contribute to the deliberative element down the line.
Yeah. As you're talking about the, you know, deliberation, maybe I should back up a second and ask you, you know, for our listeners who aren't familiar with the Facebook's Independent Oversight Board, what's the purpose of the board? What are you being tasked to do?
So it's actually, I think, will be demanding and challenging, but it's pretty straightforward. Facebook and perhaps at the end of the day, all social media do content moderation. They need to do that. And what content moderation means is that they either remove things from the platform, or they, in Facebook's case, you could say also the refusal to allow fake accounts is part of that. But there's something that has to be done to content. Sometimes it's removal, sometimes it's just making the audience smaller. And they were doing that by inside the company. They came up over time with their rules. They eventually published the rules and so on. So they were doing it inside, and I think there was a decision or a growing awareness and a decision that it was going to be difficult to do that internally, that it was too much power for one company, and that there was going to be a trust issue, that is, that people were expressing distrust and so on. So that led to thinking, well, how could we deal with that? How could we gain legitimacy for these inevitable decisions about content moderation? And by the way, let me just spend a second on that, particularly on the maybe on the libertarian side, maybe other points of view might really think, well, why does there have to be content moderation? Why can't we just have no gatekeepers and whatever is on the platform is there? And the answer, I think, is it's a business. And if you don't have the ability to remove some content, you're not going to do the job for your shareholders or your owners as well as you could, because some people are going to be put off by what's online, or they might, it's often the phrase is users won't feel safe. They'll feel like they're in an environment they don't want to be in. So it's the business part, really, that I think makes content moderation inevitable. Then you've got to make it legitimate. And that's where we come in. Facebook went to a lot of trouble, spent a lot of money to set up a trust to separate Facebook from the oversight board and to have certain kinds of qualities that would create a genuine independence, a possibility for reasonable people to see the oversight board as separate from Facebook, its business interest, or whatever. And so our job is to initially deal with appeals from Facebook takedowns, decisions about what kind of expression is on Facebook, and to answer the question, Facebook believes this expression violates the rules. Does it? And if it doesn't, if Facebook makes a mistake about a takedown, the company is committed to making our decision binding. So when something's taken down, we say it shouldn't have been, it'll go back up. There's also a couple of other things. Eventually, decisions about leaving stuff up will be also decided, so that if something's left up that shouldn't have been, we'll be able to take it down according to the Facebook community standards. And then if Facebook asks us about policies, we can give our opinions to them. And we may do that also in some of the decisions. I'm not clear about that yet. We'll have to see how that works out. But generally, it's an idea that Facebook will ask and we will tell. And then they have those are not binding. That is, the policy advice is not binding, but I think they'll probably take it pretty seriously if they go to the trouble of asking. And that's it. Yep. That's really it.
So as you were talking, I was reminded of a common, complaint online about social media and the idea of content moderation in total is, well, why can't there just be a First Amendment standard, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you were effectively responding to that question there. That there should be completely free internet speech, and therefore there should be no content moderation by Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I think that line plays well among libertarians. Mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons. I think it's often, though not always, well-intentioned. Mm-hmm. So how would you appeal specifically to a libertarian, heavy internet user? They're very engaged in social media. They're, I don't mm-hmm. know, maybe they're Redditors. They're, very, very online people, VOPs, as I call them. Mm-hmm. How would you go about saying, look, this is actually consistent with libertarian principles for companies like Facebook to be content moderating?
I think libertarians in this regard feel a tension that maybe others don't feel as strongly. And I also think they're uniquely placed to appreciate why there has to be content moderation. I mean, the tension is, on the one hand, you know, we're obviously all committed to the First Amendment, which involves the government and state action. But I think we're committed beyond the government, too. We hold free speech and freedom of expression to be a value. We think it's a good thing, along with many other kinds of liberty. But on the other hand, probably more than almost everyone, I've really come to believe, we support private property. We support property rights, and that manifests itself as, we think it's generally the case, not always, but generally the case, that the people who are best placed to make decisions about property, about business, about how a business should be run, are the board, the shareholders, and also the management, right? So on the one hand, the businesses are not covered by the First Amendment in the United States, and many of these social media companies are incorporated in the United States. So there's that open question whether you have an option about how far you protect free speech. And on the other side, there is this question I mentioned before, which is, I'm running this business. I'm really supposed to maximize value for my shareholders. And I can't do that if everybody can say anything, anytime, anywhere on my platform. So the real question in that regard, so I think the libertarian, strength there is to say, well, because of the state action, we don't want the Constitution doesn't go everywhere. It's about government. It's about state actions. And given that, it's important for businesses to have this kind of, because the system of maximizing shareholder value works great in a free market context. So I think that can be seen. On the other hand, I do think the libertarian tendency is to say, yes, we accept that. We think in some ways we'd love to have a First Amendment standard, but we understand why morally it doesn't have to be that way and legally. But what we would want is that speech that be as free as it can be, consistent with running the business, consistent with meeting your obligations to your shareholders. And that's why I was very concerned last year that I'm very happy when Facebook said that their values were what they were, but that the paramount value was voice or freedom of expression. So this is a tension that everyone has to face at the end of the day, insofar as these platforms are and social media are businesses. And the way to resolve it is to have people run the businesses that have speeches as protected as it can be, consistent with their obligations to their shareholders to make the business work. And I think that can be a long, long way. I think you can have everything that is valuable that people want to say, however offensive, you know, it can be offensive. It can be, people might not like it is what I mean there, and so on. But there have to be limits that the government doesn't have to follow. And that's written into the system and really has a lot to do with there being a private sector, actually, a private sphere in America, that in ways that maybe I didn't realize when I first started this. But if you didn't, the First Amendment applied everywhere. You know, think about the Cato Auditorium. We would have to... anybody would have, you couldn't keep people off the Cato Auditorium, could you? You couldn't select, how could you select among question and answer people, and so on and so forth. So I think that there's certainly a tension, but the resolution is to help a company draw that line in such a way that speech is as broad as it can be, given the need to have a business and have a market economy.
I suppose there's another way to think of social media upholding a First Amendment standard. And rather than thinking about it as a policy guiding their own content moderation system, thinking of it as, well, in our interactions with sovereign states, with governments, having a kind of an expectation that they treat, you know, the platform with a First Amendment standard, right? Like, I think most users don't want the government of, well, whether it's America or China, telling Facebook how to content moderate their information. So I guess if you look at it at a little bit different of an angle, there's a way in which we do want them to apply the First Amendment in their interactions with governments.
Oh, absolutely. What I haven't mentioned here is the other, I'm glad you mentioned that, the other aspect of this, which is that the first, you know, it's not just users that have or have not a First Amendment right, though that's most people. So it's important. It's also, I think, the case has been made that these companies themselves have a First Amendment right. There's an editorial right. Think about the editorial rights that newspapers have that have been established by U.S. courts. There's an editorial First Amendment element here, freedom of the press, freedom of media, in a sense, that is at issue here. We don't want, in fact, that's, for me, the strongest element in engaging with the oversight board is it just strikes me that there's a great danger that down the line we're going to get regulations and from the federal government probably that would be very intrusive on the editorial, the curation, the way these social media companies, large and small, run their companies, that you would get that kind of intrusion that I think also would be a First Amendment right. But I really don't, I mean, I think a company could vindicate that right if it came to that, but I really would rather not get there. I'd rather have a private kind of institution. I mean, that's the other libertarian element to this. We think private institutions can do a lot of stuff that many people think they can't. And I think here, so really our choices in the next few years are going to be, can a private institution make this work? Or everyone's going to conclude, well, you know, we've got to have government, I'm here to try to head that off before it happens.
It's another thing that comes to mind. And I'm not sure it's the kind of thing that's easy for me to say as someone who's, you know, I don't have any kind of relationship with the Facebook oversight board. But one of the things I've found reassuring in the last year, and it's something that, it's become more obvious over the past year for those in kind of tech policy, those who watch the sector very closely. A standard answer that we give to folks who say, well, look, that might all be true. It might be true that this is private property and, you know, Facebook has shareholders that are obliged to, you know, to think about, it's a business, it's not the government, is to say, well, they'll often say, well, it's so large that it is as if it is a government. It is as if it is a monopoly. Therefore, we should treat it like an extension of the government. And that can lead to calls for the kind of, on the extreme end, the nationalization of the internet and of social media. And even on the less extreme end, just saying, well, that's why it's okay to regulate speech and content moderation on social media, even though we wouldn't want that in other areas. But our natural response to that as people who respect property rights and are concerned about, you know, have free speech concerns, is to say, well, look, there's a right to exit. So are alternatives to Facebook. There are competitors. And if you don't like what Facebook's doing, take your business elsewhere. And so I have found that encouraging over the last year, Facebook is still a very large, very successful global corporation, one of the largest, the most successful in the world. But it has shown, it has their feet of clay might be a strong way of putting it, but it's shown that there's competition, that people are exiting dominant tech social media platforms. They're leaving Twitter for Parler. They're leaving Facebook for alternatives. Facebook, it lost, it had its TikTok clone, Lasso, that just got buried. Lasso, they shut down just, I think, a week or two ago. Just couldn't compete. One of the largest social media companies in the world got beat by TikTok. So, but that actually should be encouraging. I mean, the extent to which if Facebook messes up, if Facebook is doing a bad job, people will leave. People already have left to some extent. I mean, there have been consequences for Facebook's mistakes in the past. People, there's a lack of institutional trust, which they're trying to regain through this board. And the market is punishing them for that. So I actually find that encouraging. I probably wouldn't if I was on the board or a big shareholder of Facebook, but I find it encouraging as an individual internet consumer. What do you think, John?
That's right. I mean, of course, here we're off in sort of a different set of issues in part, which is the antitrust issue, the dominance, market dominance and all of that. But I would come back to the free speech or the speech issue in the following sense. Well, what is it that sort of breaking up or antitrust can do for you on that front end? And I think the problem is that the actual reality of this policy discussion is, in terms of really it's giving leverage to government regulators, to really ultimately to members of Congress over Facebook or other Google too is in this discussion. And it's a leverage that could be used to, this is my concern totally, but trying to avoid bad outcomes. Our study of the Federal Communications Commission, I think, that we published last year, is in fact shows many of the problems with having government having that kind of leverage, right? And then you add to it what we've seen just right at the end of May, I guess, the executive order from President Trump, which had been coming for a while. And he speaks directly there of, he tries to redefine these companies not as private forms or private entities or private companies, but rather as the modern public square. And of course, the modern public square is covered by the public forums doctrine, by the First Amendment, and so on. But in that executive order, it was you could see just the notions of leverage over what appears, over the curation decisions, over the business decisions, and people who own these platforms. I think there is a separate antitrust issue, but I think you rapidly get moving down these pathways toward leverage, toward government. You know, the thing is, the big background for me, and I should say everything I have said today is really my opinion. I would be wary in general to say this is oversight board, and I haven't talked to my colleagues. I don't know if they share this opinion or not. But it just seems to me that the big issue is in 2016 and maybe a little before, it became apparent that these social media companies were very important to political discussion, and especially discussion around elections, to mobilizing voters, to getting out the vote, and persuading voters to some degree. And anytime that happens, elected officials are going to perk up because they're aware that their fate. They're very concerned about how these platforms, or any platform. They were very concerned about television in the 1960s, and particularly 1968. And I see 2016 in many ways as the 1968 for social media. It's everyone gets interested because this can affect elections. And in that context, when you're thinking of leverage, whether it comes from direct or some kind of other argument about policy, again, I'm wary. That's the liberal element. The liberal element is you don't want government deciding these questions about what speech can be heard directly or indirectly.
Now, one of the challenges that has faced social media companies, including Facebook, including Twitter, and it's been interesting to see them now. I think all of them have started the rollout. They've been deliberating on how they should change their policies over the last year or two. Mm-hmm. And now in 2020, we're seeing them actually do it. Mm-hmm. One of these things was, I think all of the big companies have tried to take on COVID-19 pandemic disinformation. Mm-hmm. By flagging this tweet may or may not be, accurate information about COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Be aware, mm-hmm. Here's a reputable source that you can double check this tweet. I think Facebook's been involved in that somewhat as well. It's also shown up in, I think, Twitter most prominently. I'm not sure where Facebook's at this point in this mm-hmm. regard, but Twitter has also taken on Donald Trump's Twitter account and flagged some of his tweets. And that's mm-hmm. been a very controversial thing, whether or not, whether or not an elected public official should, whether or not they're telling the truth, media companies have a responsibility to post it because it's in the public interest, whether or not it's true, that there's like a special carve out for public figures. And Twitter has decided to flag some of Trump's tweets. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a new thing. That's really picked up here in 2020. Do you feel like, and this is not just a Facebook question, it's kind mm-hmm. of social media in general. Do you think they've done enough or too much in regards to disinformation, whether political or medical, I suppose? Mm-hmm. And what kind of grade would you give these efforts thus far?
Well, the issue here is it's entirely possible that later this year I will find myself on a panel trying to judge Facebook about these matters. And I would say for a couple, and in general, I think, particularly with regard to Facebook, I would say I'm going to pull back from saying anything definite there. I think there's a lot on the record there. about that, and people can find that for sure. And the second thing I would say that goes beyond just a general recusal that I think is a good idea, but because of my position, is, it's become more apparent to me that judging any of it, that for anyone, anywhere, judging these kinds of matters really requires indications about details and circumstances that in particular cases with regard to this, I simply don't know that. I don't know enough about those. And so if I were on this board, I think I'm knowing what I know, I think I should be a little wary about making judgments because I don't know those circumstances. What I would say is I think the companies are thinking about this in terms of very, I'd say, typical terms for free speech, right? Remember John Stuart Mill and On Liberty, and Mill announces the only, and defends the idea that the only grounds for restricting someone's liberty is because of harm done to others. And it strikes me that these kinds of arguments about what we've been going through for all of these companies, or for anyone who is interested in freedom of speech and the importance of freedom of speech in a pandemic, are going to be thinking about the Mill's harm principle and what that might mean. The other aspect I would say, and here I'll say, of course, this has come down on Twitter, and it's been a Twitter issue, is, again, I would point to the interaction of political officials and these social media companies. It can be apart from everything else, it's just a very difficult situation for people trying to run these companies. And again, politicians are highly concerned about what appears, how they appear. And I think what we want is, as people living in a liberal culture, a culture that respects ideas like free speech and freedom of opinion and conscience, is we want that separation. And I just think I would say, without giving anyone a grade, this whole year has shown the challenges. And to that extent, if something like the Oversight Board, forget Facebook, imagine there's some kind of institution that one of these other companies comes up with that can work. It's a real, it's a real good thing. It would be something that would solve some of these issues that I think we've seen across the board here this year. And you can see why people running the companies would like to have someone who would have a legitimate role to play and have a really get people's agreement to their judgments, because it's just, you gotta getting caught in our American politics or politics in many other countries is a tough thing right now for everybody. And I think that's where the institution building comes in.
Well, I can imagine. Thinking about the, I asked you about grading or whatever, but that you can imagine as these institutions grow and become settled, and that includes the Oversight Board, as it becomes a more robust and mature entity. You can imagine essentially a whole apparatus of other institutions that act, that attempt to explain the decisions that the Oversight Board is making, to interpret them, to even push them in certain directions. I'm thinking here of the ways in which in like university education, there are, when it comes to university free speech issues, there's a whole network of nonprofits who look at universities and how they handle the speech rights of their faculty and their students and literally grade them. Like the grade for Purdue University is a B minus, and that's up from a C plus last year. I mean, I'm thinking here the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, groups like that. And you can imagine in the future, institutions building out that will rate the decisions that the Facebook Oversight Board, you know, and depending on the priors of the group doing the grading or the rating, they'll get very different results. But that's actually the sign of a maturing system, a maturing set of institutions. So that could be something.
That's absolutely. I thought about this before all this started. I mean, I think one crucial role for what you've just been talking about, let's say an institution that one of the major social media or in general social media is just to keep track of where we are. We tend to go in general in American politics from one blow up to the other, right? And so that's something the real things that happened 2 or 3 months ago seem like they happened decades ago. Or they quickly get forgotten, and you suddenly say to yourself, do you remember that? We were all over each other in February about that. One role that play in what this kind of institution is to keep track of everything that's happened and how and give you an overall picture of how things are developing. It's certainly true of the Oversight Board, or I suspect any institution like it, is that they're going to want to, their great advantage possibility is to give consistency to decisions. They can, the rules become more consistent. Now, external, more speech is the issue. If that's not happening, it's even possible that a board itself might not notice that there were inconsistencies in its handling. And part of, the Supreme Court, part of what law reviews do is show some of the implications that the justices might not have thought about in some of their decisions and so on. I do hope that everything works well enough that these kinds of issues, these institutions of accountability rise up and make the whole process work better. If those things happen, we will have gotten well down the road toward a functioning system.
There's an interesting example. It's a bit obscure as a matter of jurisprudence and kind of legal history, but and most folks aren't aware of this, but in the 19th century, the overwhelming majority of what we would recognize as jurisprudence, I mean, there obviously was a Supreme Court back then, there were federal courts and state courts, but a lot of everyday law was actually decided in alternative court systems, the most prominent of which was ecclesiastical courts. And so a lot of, just Protestants and in the 19th century America, there's injunctions in the Bible not to take a fellow Christian to court. And they took those pretty seriously. And so they would go to their church leaders and say, hey, we've got this disagreement over who paid for what. And we want you to sort it because we don't, we're not going to take this to the court system. And so over time, there grew up this whole system of ecclesiastical courts in America. Imitating courts in other parts of the world that would rule on issues of, basically torts, civil liability, would rule on inheritance disagreements, who gets the money from the estate, on even on issues like divorce and whatnot. So we had this whole separate, spontaneously organized, grassroots generated system of jurisprudence that had to evolve and grow over time. And eventually it got absorbed back into the standard secular legal system. But in a sense, I kind of see that's what's happening here with like the Facebook Oversight Board. As these systems have grown, and content moderation is hard, content moderation at scale is hard, and they're having to develop their own kind of informal court system. It's not the same as a legal court, but it's over time they're generating this kind of alternative legal system that has different standards than the formal legal system, right? There is not a First Amendment requirement in the same way there would be in a formal legal system, but nor should there be. And it's very cool as someone observing, we're seeing kind of legal history in the making as these alternative jurisprudential systems are generated, grow, mature, and develop into these robust institutions. And it's neat seeing you being part of that, John. So,
I'm very happy to be part of it. I think there are two broad ways forward, actually. And I appreciate your comments. We don't really know enough about these kinds of judicial institutions that aren't official and legal and coercive, ultimately. I think that's great to know more about that. The two ways forward, though, are one is that for whatever reason, you get a more centralized oversight system. So the trust for the OSB is set up in such a way that other companies can join it if they want to. They can make use of the services, as it were. And then the question is, will they want to, and all of those questions. So that's a model that you would get going one direction. And libertarians like the American Supreme Court, I think, but there's also dispersed power and spontaneous order, as you said. So the other possibility is that you get a variety of different kinds of institutions. And indeed, that's what you have now, right? We have an oversight board, but we also have content moderators that themselves deal with the outside world as well as the content moderation decisions. We have smaller companies in which one or two people deal with their content moderation. We have diversity at this point. We have other things, technological, coming online that I've heard about that will make other kinds of institutions. I think in that model where you have a lot of, call it a kind of strong federalism or a very decentralized content moderation system, the role of something like Facebook's oversight board is to learn stuff as we go through time, and that stuff gets diffused. And that's also in a federalist governance system, that it, maybe it's how the lines are drawn around some issues about that limit speech or don't limit speech. Maybe it's other things that, and lessons that are learned. Even though Facebook is large and OSB will be dealing with a large number of issues, there still can be lessons, I think, that will be important, because other companies may wish to have different kinds of content moderation that draw the lines differently, that have different institutions that are accountable to different people in different ways. My prejudice is for, by going in, is for letting a thousand flowers bloom. And maybe that, although I always use, have you ever noticed, use that phrase?
Right?
It's Mao Zedong. And, that general theory is that he let a thousand flowers bloom to clip them. So the people who... the people who spoke out ended up dead, right? Or in jail. Right. So that's not my wish at all about the, my wish is that you have a lot of diversity, try lots of stuff. It's the Hayekian thing, right? You go out there and there is spontaneous orders developed that are different from, not everyone has to be like the oversight board, but it also could be that down the line, for a variety of reasons I don't see right now, companies will come to the trust and say, you know, this work is working pretty well. We think it's better to go with you than to try to do our own thing. We think we want to sign on to your rules because they've worked or they've got general legitimacy. I don't know what the reasoning will be, but I do know my own starting prejudice is for diversity and not unitary system. But we'll see. It's most important is that it be not come out of Washington or a state capital, too, for that matter.
That's very true. Well, and that would lend legitimacy. As you have more, if you got that kind of buy-in someday from another, outfit other than Facebook, well, it only enhances the authority and legitimacy of the oversight board. I mean, because, I don't think it's necessarily a reasonable suspicion, but people are going to be suspicious that because Facebook set up this independent oversight board that might not truly be independent and so on. And, having more buy-in down the line would would mitigate that. And even if they don't buy into your specific to this oversight board, if they just say, this is working for Facebook, let's have our own version of that. It'll be independent. It'll be set up along similar lines, have pretty similar structures, pretty similar, basic priors. That itself, I think it would be a success.
So let me just speak to that for a second. And I think I can comment on this, the question of independence that you mentioned. I think I would say to people listening to this, what I've seen so far in my fellow members of the oversight board is far from the question, what does Facebook want us to do or whatever, or a dependence on Facebook? Just the contrary. What I've seen is people, an incipient pride on being independent of Facebook among members of the board, and a sense that our job is, our role here, which is, this is a crucial issue, a professional role definition, right? And I've seen in the early stages a sense that we're here to be independent. That's what we offer to the Facebook and to the world, and it's our job. And I feel good about that. And I think that's what, in the end of the day, what everybody wants. But I do think it's also what the members are starting out. They're expecting it from themselves and from the board. So that's good. I feel good about that.
That's encouraging to hear. Now, I got to tell you that when I Googled John Sample's Facebook board, an ad popped up from some organization called Accountable Tech, which was completely non-transparent. There was no accountability for who was funding this thing, but it told me to quote, tell John Sample's, don't be complicit. John Sample's and the Facebook oversight board were supposed to tackle vital content issues, but the board has been reduced to a PR prop as Facebook profits off hate and subverts democracy. So they told me to tell you, John. So I've told you. But have you seen an uptick in angry emails coming your way since the announcement?
You know, I just have to say, I was on Facebook, and it's a striking moment. You know, I'm a fairly obscure individual that just worked away at the Cato Institute. And you're going through Facebook and suddenly an ad pops up in your timeline that has your name in it. It's directed to you. It's like, what have I gotten myself into here? But I think what's missing here is, people, first of all, I was sort of like, you can't say anything, Samples. You favor critical speech. These people are doing it. Yeah, they're sure they have a right to it. I think the fact that they were willing to spend money on it tells me that we should pause and consider what they say. The real issue here was, they've got us failing, and we haven't failed because we haven't done anything. We're trying to get ready to hear cases and we are making good progress to hear cases this fall. So they're judging us unfairly, I think, in the sense that, we have to do something before you can decide that we have failed. If you want to impose on, that they were imposing on us this idea that you're supposed to be doing all of this and that right now. But it was never the case that that was part of what we signed on to do, the way the institution was defined and so on. So I think it's a bit of an unfair judgment. And what I would reply to them is to say, it's unfair at this point. We're getting ready to go, but from what I know of my colleagues is they want what you want, which is they want an independent board that will give us some legitimate and trustworthy content moderation. So that would be my response. And we'll see what others like. I do not, I have not gotten any. At Cato, my colleagues, and maybe you too, maybe you're like this too. A lot of my colleagues would get more hate mail than I did. And I always wondered when I was failing. Was I like too, did I not make the case very well? Or was people just weren't listening to me? Was it a failure that I didn't get these kind of ugly emails from people? So at some point I stopped worrying, but I think it's sort of a general thing. I don't get it.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. Yeah. I think they just auto-filled like, oh, you searched for a board name, you know,
everyone got
Facebook board and you've searched for John Sample, so we'll pop his name in there, you know? So I'm sure it was automated, but, no, I'm with you in that category. I don't get much hate mail. And, in fact, I'm always vaguely insulted that on Twitter, you know, when people would do the like anti-Semitic, like if you say something, that is, there was this phase like 2 years ago on Twitter where people were making anti-Semitic attacks on journalists. And so the journalists would preempt it by putting the parenthetical, three parentheticals on each side of their name.
Yeah.
And, you know, no one ever accused me of being a shill for the Rothschilds or something. And so I was like, am I not being, you know, fighting hate hard enough? So you and me, John, both, you know.
I thought you wonder about that. Yeah. I don't. At the same time, I mean, I think this will be an interesting thing for me down the line. I'm the decisions are tough ones, and I hope people keep that.
They're going to be controversial no matter what.
Right. And so the controversy will lead to some. So what will be those of us who talked about offensive speech and tough speech and all of that, people like me, for example, are going to have to live out our faith, I think, that because there could be hard things said about all of us, about our effort. And, you know, I've always, members of Congress would always say, you know, they didn't like ads or negative ads because it was untrue and so on. Well, you know, there may be untrue things said about me down the line, and I'm just we'll return to this, Paul. And if I cave, I hope you're going to attack me for giving up my principles. if I complain about offensive speech or whatever, a call for a limit on advertising or something like that, I hope you'll attack me. I'll deserve it.
That's right. Well, I'm not going to hold my breath, but yes. Well, you heard John say it. He wants us at Building Tomorrow to help keep him accountable to the principles that all who value civil liberty share. We'll check back in with him next year and see how it's gone. Let me also say while I have you with me, be sure to go check out libertarianism.org's newly redesigned website. It's not only a fresh coat of paint, though it does look snazzy, it also allows us to do some cool things, connecting topics with each other and highlighting content that is both relevant and incisive. And as usual, till next time, be well. This episode of Building Tomorrow was produced by Landry Ayers for libertarianism.org. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, check out our online encyclopedia or subscribe to one of our half dozen podcasts.